Welcome. It's This Is Going Well, I Think, with David Cooper. And I am David Cooper. It's This Is Going Well, I Think, the show where no one's listening. No one cares. The show where every episode's the last episode. Here's what's coming tonight. Carmi Levy, tech expert, is going to go over the stories in the technology industry of the day, including a security breach that the company Cisco has recently revealed. That isn't just your regular, everyday hackers. It's state-sponsored hacking, and Carmi and I are going to pick that apart, including Tesla autopilot crashes. That's going to be a barrel of monkeys. And then an Irishman with the gift of the gab, a man who's an environmental auditor who is going to tell us why you don't have to shower as much as you think you do. I myself have terrible hygiene. Tony Five, who's on the show regularly, my girlfriend Miranda, they all give me a hard time about stinking because I only shower every month? No, every 3 or 4 days. And in the summer more. But I'm going to have a man who made national headlines in the UK by saying, you don't need to shower every day. In fact, if you do, you might be a terrible person. So that's what's coming up. I don't have a ton of time because I'm cooking dinner for friends. But in lieu of some news stories, I'm going to tell you what I'm making. Spaghetti and clams, spaghetti vongole, with spicy breadcrumbs on top, and then I'm making a handmade Caesar salad. I've been mashing anchovies all day. Love anchovies. If you don't like anchovies, you just think you don't like them. You probably do. That's what's going in the Caesar salad. So without further ado, let's check in with Tony Five with our very special segment, The Siemens Alive with Tony Five. Oh, in case you're just tuning in and you haven't heard any of these, Tony's on a cruise ship somewhere in the Mediterranean and he's doing a log each day. So let's play that. Commence Tony's update from the sea, Thursday, May the 2nd, day 8.
Good morning, David. Good morning, listeners. Today is day 84 of my trip away. I'm currently in the port of Cannes on my own private yacht. I say my own private yacht. I'm on a tender back to the ship and nobody's come back on board. So I think the law of the sea is if you're on a ship, and you're alone, you can claim it. I've seen that in Pirates of the Caribbean. So I take that as legal. So in terms of maritime law, you may now call me Captain Tony Five. It's all going well. That noise is us reversing out as we're going port, starboard and aft, whatever that means. And yeah, heading back to the ship. Cannes, lovely. Obviously famous for the Cannes Film Festival, as you're quite aware. And other bits and pieces. They do speak French here, which is a bit of a problem, but not everywhere is perfect. Yeah, it's having a great time, to be fair. It's all going well. I've worked on my tan. And loving life, David, loving life. So, listeners, you may get the legend that is Mrs. Tony V tonight. I've prepared her. I'm going to feed and water her. Going to bring her up from the lower cabins. And you might be some lucky and get to hear Tony V's mum live on the ocean waves. I leave you now and I bid you farewell as I take to the oceans. Goodbye, farewell, and bon anniversaire. Good afternoon, David. This is Tony Five live from the seas. We are now heading somewhere else. There's a lot of water about, so I guess we're moving. I've got a tan now, David. I'm growing my hair out, so we're doing well here. Just left Cannes. Didn't want to buy a boat. Didn't see one a colour of that one. But I'm here with a special guest, David. That's right. I have met a celebrity on board. Her name is Mary. She's from, where are you from, Mary?
Florida.
David, she's from Florida. She doesn't live near Disneyland. But apparently there is a place called Florida. She has a pet alligator, David. She's amazing. So this is my friend, David. You say hello.
And we're buying a boat in Cannes.
I mean,
it's 100 foot.
She knows what's going on. She knows it's 100 yeah. foot. Her husband's there. He doesn't feel insecure at all, David. And
check for us.
Yeah, they're loving life, David. So this is my friend, David. He's a wonderful Jewish guy. Don't hold it against him. Yeah. He does a radio show. He's got about three people that listen to him.
All right.
So obviously with you two...
Four people.
Yeah, you've essentially...
A growing audience.
Yeah, growing audience. That's the husband. He's only allowed to speak sometimes, David. But with that, you've obviously doubled his audience size. So he's doing well. So he wanted me to meet people on board. All he right. always thinks I'm on some sort of prison ship. Yeah. It's slightly racist, but that's David. But David, so just to let you know, I have met people on board. They are real. This isn't a prison ship, and we're doing very well. So just to let you know, we're all good. Thank you to all the listeners out there. Please, if you want to request
and
a postcard.
Wearing his orange shirt.
And I'm wearing an orange shirt, as Mary said. All right, guys.
See you, David.
And that's Rich. Again, he was allowed to speak. Mary just gave him the thumbs up. All right, guys. Look after yourself. Bye-bye.
There he goes, Tony Five. And by he goes, I mean I'm no longer playing any more recordings of him, and still nothing from his mother, but it's a buildup, he says. When he finally brings his mother on, you're going to love it. So let's mosey on over to Carmi Levy, tech expert, to talk about state-sponsored cyber attacks. Ooh. Oh my goodness, it's Carmi Levy, technology expert, extraordinaire, expatriate. Those are the only three words I know with X, and I think only two of them apply. Carmi, welcome.
So good to be here. Who starts a conversation with me with, oh my goodness, other than my wife? So thank you. That was delightful.
Oh boy, trouble in paradise?
No, not at all. Oh. Usually she's just happy to see me, and you are as well. So thank you.
Oh,
I appreciate that.
So if there's not trouble in paradise and your wife's saying, oh my goodness, you know what? That's for the X-rated after show. That'll be on our OnlyFans.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. We'll take that off of the federally regulated airwaves.
Sure. Sorry. It's not OnlyFans. For me, it's OnlyFan because we have one listener of the show.
No, my wife tunes in, but of course that would make her my fan though, right? Because she started as my fan, but she has become your fan. So
it's similar to the way my family listens to my show only when I have guests on who they like. They never listen. I was watching Frasier the other day, and Frasier was talking about something that happened on the afternoon show, not his show, mm-hmm. because the host made fun of him. For those who don't know that show, the main character works at a radio station. And, you know, his whole family is like, wow, we were listening to the radio. And they're like, how often do you get to hear one of your family members discussed on the radio? And Frasier's like, does anyone listen to my show?
Every day. I so relate.
Thank you. Do your kids watch your stuff?
Not on broadcast television, but interestingly, my daughter, who is graduating college this month, she was in a lab with one of her fellow students, and her fellow student pulls out a phone and says, hey, I saw your dad on TikTok, because apparently one of my segments ended up on TikTok. So that's how my kid watches me on her friend's TikTok on her friend's phone.
See, that if that's not love and support, I don't know what is.
Or, yeah, you know, grudging, accidental, somewhat spontaneous. Whatever it is, I'll take it.
So
she saw me.
I'm a nerd. I code. I used to code. And that's how I got a green card. And that's how I can live in New York and try to be in radio. Not important. I mean, at this point, it's because I got a sugar mama, but that's not important. This story that you brought to my attention was particularly interesting to me, but it's involving a security breach that Cisco had, but Cisco's not just saying, hey, it's regular hackers. They're saying this looks like state-sponsored hacking. In this case, a state-sponsored spyware campaign. Why don't you walk me through it? Because there's some thoughts about it, and there's a related story that happened a few months ago that blew my mind, but for anyone who isn't a nerd, it might not blow their mind. But on to the Cisco thing. What happened there?
Yeah, so Cisco posted a blog entry last week. They called it Arcane Door, and they said that it was an espionage-focused campaign whose sophistication betrayed the fact that it was had to have been carried out by state-sponsored actors targeting perimeter network devices from multiple vendors. They found victims around the world, and the target was government networks.
Yep.
And so they are saying, if you are a cybersecurity agency agency in Canada, Australia, the UK. You are being advised to take a look at your networks, and you are being advised to update whatever Cisco devices you have on those networks to cut off the risk here, reduce the vulnerability, and move on from it. This is highly unusual. I mean, patches are constantly being released. Vendors like Cisco are always identifying weaknesses, vulnerabilities, and sending out updates. It is incredibly rare to share this level of notification that it crosses not just their hardware, but other vendors' hardware, and that it's targeting government agencies, government networks, and that it is state-sponsored. What's unprecedented here is that I've never seen a company like Cisco say, we're pretty sure this is state-sponsored, you better act now.
Well, let's pick that apart, because how can a company say it's state-sponsored or it's likely state-sponsored? My understanding, and you may disagree or you may affirm, if a hack or spyware or anything like this is so sophisticated, it would take many millions of dollars, huge teams of programmers. It's not the act of a lone wolf, because it's just too complicated. To get something like this done, you would need such infrastructure that it's likely only a state would have that infrastructure. Is that what makes a reek of state sponsored?
That's what it seems to be, because they were decidedly cryptic in the blog post. Obviously, they don't want to give too much away. On the one hand, you want to inform stakeholders so that they can take the appropriate actions to protect themselves, but you don't want to share so much that you tip off those who are prosecuting the attacks in the first place and give them information that can help them in future. So they're using the term, they say it was a sophisticated campaign and it used multiple layers of novel techniques. And they're saying this matches signatures of espionage technology, espionage patterns that they've seen before from state-sponsored actors. And so it ultimately comes down to resources. Do they have access to the compute resources? Do they have access to the network capacity, the training, the other tools that, you know, someone who's operating on an individual basis, maybe in mom's basement, simply wouldn't have the ability to. Maybe they could do one of those techniques, but when you combine them all, so that when, you know, one lock is closed back up, there's another one waiting to take its place. They're saying that this is pretty clear. It was not the act of an individual. Pretty clear that based on their past experience, this is coming from a much higher authority with greater resources, and, you know, ergo, it's got to be state-sponsored.
So here's why this story piqued my interest. Something happened in the nerd community about a month ago. It's called the XZ attack, or I guess in Canada, the XZ attack.
XZ?
I'm not going to explain too much what XZ is, but essentially, if you have an iPhone, if you have a Mac, if you have a router, if you have a server, if you have any computer that is having its lineage from Unix, so Linux, if you don't know what that means, it doesn't matter, but Mac is one of those computers, you likely have this tool installed. It's a free tool that is available to anyone. So it's available for systems designers, and it's essentially a decompression tool. So I want to send a huge amount of data, I compress it, I make it into a smaller size, and then I run this tool to decompress it, blah, blah, blah. If I've lost you, it doesn't matter. I think you can still follow. Long story short, about 3 years ago, someone started contributing some code to this tool. And then they started contributing more and more. And the people who own the tool said, oh, this is, you know, this person can be one of the regular contributors. Then out of nowhere, someone's just testing something random and they notice a small blip on their computer. Maybe the processor is running too fast. And they start investigating this tool. And they notice that if you install this tool, it installs a backdoor into pretty much every server ever, because Linux is the operating system on every server. Or most servers. And long story short, this person had such a complicated patch for this tool that, and the level of sophistication is so high. For example, if I downloaded the tool and built it myself, if I downloaded the code for the tool and built it myself, it wouldn't trigger the attack. It would only run for systems designers who are shipping servers. I think I've kind of lost the mark here in an attempt to explain this, because it is a really complicated worm. But the long story short is some random person out of the goodwill of their hearts started submitting patches to a piece of code. And lo and behold, those patches create a worm that could have opened a backdoor in pretty much every server in the United States, in Europe, everywhere. It was caught ahead of time. The patches didn't make it into generally available releases, but it shocked the open source or the nerd community, because anyone, you know, it could be anyone. Anyone submitting patches to these pieces of code that end up on our iPhone, you know, and the level of sophistication is such that it is likely state-sponsored. That's how complicated it is.
It's a wake-up call to those of us who have always believed, and I'm one of them. I believe in the power of the open source community, both to develop software, to develop content like on Wikipedia, that you trust the masses to do the right thing, and you trust the masses, those who contribute to any open source project, to be able to identify when one individual among them is behaving in an anomalous manner, is doing something that violates the sanctity of the community, that is criminal in nature. And I think this is a stark reminder that that isn't always the case, that as good as the open source community is at creating software that is greater than the sum of its parts and saving developers around the world huge amounts of resources because they don't have to develop every last utility and piece of code on their own. They can rely on the open source community to be there for them. That sometimes you will have a bad actor in that group, in that community, who ruins it for everyone. And in much the same way that Wikipedia, you get one person who vandalizes a page and maybe the community will catch it. 9 times out of 10, they will. But, you know, there's the occasional time that they won't. In a case like this, it was undetected until the very last minute. And thankfully, we're fine. But I think it reinforces the fact that we still can't unequivocally trust everyone in the open source community. We have to do what Ronald Reagan said all those years ago. You have to trust but verify. And it really is a black mark on open source because it is a wonderful platform for developing greater capability and building community around code. But at the same time, not every human who participates in open source is necessarily going to have everyone's best interests at heart. And state-sponsored cyber criminals and state-sponsored cyber organizations know this full well, that they can go a long way if they manage to infiltrate these communities and do their bidding that way.
It got me thinking, some of these nerds, you know, the 60-year-old big beard with the potato chips, you know, the real stereotypical nerd. You could just send, like, a young woman to, like, you know, infiltrate or, you know, like the Russians would do with their spy craft.
Yeah, but, exactly. Boris and Natasha. It's not that difficult.
Yeah, but I don't know that I agree with you because there's something called the Linus's Law. Linus is the author of Linux, which is a widely used open source tool.
Yep.
And his law is, given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. So in my view, this is the community actually functioning properly. They caught the thing. Play it out at Microsoft.
So how did they miss it here? You know, like, that's sort of the question. If the community is supposed to be self-regulating and to find where those glitches in the system, in the matrix are, why was this one missed until so late in the process?
Well, it didn't ship to these stable releases. It was in the testing area of these operating systems.
Smaller population then.
Yeah, and so that's when it did work. It just, you know, the bug did get merged, but
yeah,
or the attack did get merged. But the last thing I will say is this: if it happened at Microsoft, you know, some employee, some immigrant in the United States coming from a country that is adversarial towards the U.S., maybe a Russian, they've been in the U.S. 20 years, but they're a spy, they get a job at Microsoft, they plant a worm into Windows, it would be on Microsoft to catch these things, and I don't know that they would. So it goes both ways. Like, it can happen in the corporate, proprietary, closed source world. It can also happen in the open source world.
Agreed. And I think we have to disavow ourselves of the notion that just because it's a corporation or just because it's a government agency or just because it's an open source community, that it's somehow immune to cyber insecurity, is somehow immune to efforts by foreign actors to penetrate code bases for their own geopolitical aims. And so the risk is everywhere. And unfortunately, states or state-sponsored actors in this regard are getting better at figuring out where those sort of threat surfaces are and how to infiltrate them. And I think it means we've got to start putting or continue to put more resources into protective cybersecurity efforts and resources and tools and processes and training. Because obviously the threat landscape getting more turbulent by the day.
When we come back, Elon Musk stinks. Tesla's autopilot and full self-driving mode has been linked to hundreds of crashes, dozens of deaths. I look forward to a little bit of schadenfreude. That's joy from others' misfortune. Obviously, I'm not happy about the people dying, but I don't like Teslas. We're going to come back with Carmi Levy and pick this one apart. Car Army, you made it to the show. Yesterday, I sang my introduction to my show, and a listener, a woman named Lauren, who claims to be my only fan from Detroit, because remember back when I was back on, when I used to be on the air, I used to be on CKLW, which is a Detroit radio station, not important, totally getting off the mark. But Lauren wrote in this: last night I turned on your show, and as soon as you started singing along to the opening theme, my 10-year-old sleeping dog straight up shot into the air and ran, in bold, ran out of the room and down the hall. Never in the past decade has my dog ever done anything like this. You have such talent. I thought you would want to know. So,
oh my God, I love that.
I'm going to start singing more because Lauren's obviously our only listener. She signs it, your only listener in Detroit. Also, my only listener not in Detroit. I'm going to start singing more to scare Lauren's dog.
I say do it. I'll play it for my dog and see if, you know, we can maybe get some scientific research going. Is this a dog thing? Maybe. I'd love to find out what kind of dog she has.
Me too. Maybe she'll be listening. Maybe she'll email me. Lauren, what kind of dog do you have? It's yesterday's show. It would have been May 1st show. The first 30 seconds, the introduction is special where I sing along with the theme song.
I'll play it for my dog and let you know what happens.
Good. Carmi, Teslas. I hate them.
Oh, you're not the only one. I mean, everyone seems to have a I saw my first Cybertruck moment, and very few of them are actually complimentary. It looks like something a grade two kid would, you know, design on the back of his workbook.
Are you baiting me? Because I saw one an hour ago and I told you that, and it looked like shit. That's right, I swore.
Yeah, they're kind of iffy. I wouldn't want to, like, actually lean up against one. They look like they would hurt me. Just those sharp, creased edges. Oh, man. I don't know.
And that's... you need a tetanus shot if one hits you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
They rust. They rust.
Yeah, they call it stainless steel. It isn't exactly stainless, folks. So let the buyer beware.
If you spill your coffee on it, it's fine. But if you just get rain on it, it's going to rust. Yeah. Okay, so Tesla's got this autopilot that Elon Musk said would be delivered in the 1980s or something. Maybe it was a little after that, but it's long overdue.
Yeah.
They've kind of maybe sort of delivered it. Some states kind of maybe sort of allow it. But it's kind of maybe not safe.
It isn't. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has opened an investigation into what they say are hundreds of cases, hundreds of accidents, and dozens of deaths where Tesla vehicles drove into either individuals, so people, pedestrians, or vehicles that were either stopped or moving slowly. And this is, at the time, autopilot, or the more sophisticated full self-driving semi-autonomous services were engaged. And there's no indication in these, and that's what the investigation will bear out, as to whether the humans who were driving these vehicles were sufficiently engaged in the act of driving or were notified that they were about to have an accident and should take over from the automation. So this has been a problem with this technology since day one, is that, you know, Tesla leads the industry. They're the first ones to really sort of push this into the mainstream. They started with autopilot and then introduced the full self-driving. And just the fact that they're called autopilot and full self-driving, I think, is disingenuous and misleading, because it suggests that these are autonomous. And on the sort of spectrum of autonomy, where level 5 is full self-driving, where, you know, humans never have to take over because the technology is perfect in every use case, to level 0, which is humans driving and no automation whatsoever, level 1, which is just basic cruise control, level 2, which is somewhat more sophisticated cruise control, I think it's safe to say that autopilot and FSD are kind of maybe level 2, 2.5. They're not that sophisticated, and humans still have to be ready, hands on the wheel, to take over at a moment's notice if the technology is unable to continue. And that is clearly not happening. We continue to see YouTube videos of people napping at the wheel, of relying too much on the technology. When they had their 1 month free offer to existing Tesla users to get them to buy it, you saw this absolute explosion in videos on social media where people would drive from one side of town to the other and look at me, I'm recording my video, and look at the car, it's driving itself. We've allowed Tesla to determine the trajectory of this technology with no accountability for what happens when people get killed. And honestly, I think that's a problem, because I think now people are buying these vehicles and buying the upgrade. It was $12,000. They just lowered it to $8,000. But they assume this technology is automation, and it isn't. And that's getting people killed.
Is Tesla the front runner for AI driving, or are there other companies that are doing it maybe better?
Right now, it's safe to say that Tesla has the most number of vehicles equipped with this technology on the road simply because they've been at it for longer, but they are not the only vendor. Ford, for example, has its Blue Cruise technology, which is also, ironically, under investigation by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. But that's not for hundreds of accidents. That's just for two so far. General Motors has Super Cruise in a number of its vehicles as well. But because Ford and GM and you know, Mercedes has and BMW has, pretty much every major vendors introducing its own answer to Tesla's technology, but they don't have the numbers of vehicles on the roads yet to generate the kinds of data that we're seeing coming out of Tesla. It's only a matter of time before we do, because none of them are level five either. In fact, Mercedes is marketing the heck out of the fact that it just introduced a level three, the world's first level three technology. We're still two levels below full automation. So even that isn't enough. And even that is probably going to touch off a wave of drivers who buy this thing thinking that it's a really great party trick and everything is amazing until you pile into someone who whose only sin was being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Absolutely. Last August, September, I was in San Francisco, and I know the city allowed for a pilot program, that company Cruise, to have driverless. It's not even AI drivers with the person.
Nobody
sitting
in the vehicle. Yeah.
And I was on the road with these things. I mean, they don't go freeway or highway speeds. They're very slow, and I think they haven't caused too many injuries yet, or maybe they have, I don't know. But it was just so weird. I rented a car. I needed one to drive up to go to some wedding, and I was sharing the road with these things, and they're really obnoxious, and they're so slow, and they never make the left-hand turn, and they drive you crazy. But they do seem like they're a little too safe.
They are. And in fact, it's funny. So I think that pilot is now ended because they found that they were too tentative. And there were some protesters who, when they encountered them on the roads, would deliberately try to mess them up, would put like traffic cones in their way, or would stand in front of them until they sort of hesitated and essentially rebooted themselves. It was actually quite amusing. And they dialed back that program for exactly that reason, you know, because the technology simply isn't ready for the rigors of the real world. And I think Tesla's technology would be ready if human drivers understood its limitations. But again, the way it's being marketed is somewhat, or actually let's call a spade, incredibly misleading. And unfortunately it's problematic. This is one of those cases where I wish we had better legislation that forced companies like Tesla to be more responsible when they introduce technology like this. You know, it's what I find interesting is if you look really closely at a vehicle, every single part on it is subject to some kind of federal regulation. If you want to have a certain kind of lens on your headlight, that has to be approved for inclusion in your design. Yet for whatever reason, because it's software, I don't know, that seems to be carte blanche. Companies can do whatever they want. And so we don't really have federal transportation regulations that apply specifically to this automation software. And that also needs to change because there are some who would accuse companies like Tesla of getting away with murder, of not appreciating the safety implications of these technologies, ignoring the data, all in the interest of selling a very high margin piece of software on their vehicles.
I feel like cars were being mass produced at a time in American history when the government was more of a social democracy. You know, the New Deal, Medicare, Medicaid, like it was a time when the country cared about people more. And so they regulated the safety of cars. When cars started adding software to their, this is just a, you know, a cockamamie, this is just a wild theory, but when cars started adding software to the mix, the U.S. government had gone much more deregulated, much more right wing. And so they never really bothered to update those regulations. So when it comes to hardware, it has a legacy of regulation. And when it comes to software, it doesn't. That's my theory. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it has any basis in reality.
I think it's certainly worthy of further discussion. Certainly when you watch lawmakers as they hold those committee meetings on Capitol Hill and they bring in big tech senior executives and they grill them, it's pretty obvious by the questions they ask and the conversations that they have that they don't truly understand what makes this tech industry tick. And so it's a case of where the lawmakers in the software realm really don't understand what they're talking about, and so can't regulate something that they don't fully get. And I think that's on us. That's on voters. That, you know, when you vote for someone, you look for certain skills, and you know, going forward, I think one of those skills needs to be tech savviness. And when someone asks you for their vote, You better make sure that they're able to legislate on things like automation in vehicles or other aspects of technology, because if they don't understand software and services and networking and bandwidth and telecom issues and all that stuff, then I really don't think they should be crafting laws that affect all of these things going forward.
I don't either. If you're talking about Canadian politics, maybe. If you're talking about American politics, good luck.
Yeah, exactly. I can ask for it until, you know, the cows come home. It's probably not going to happen. Certainly not in our lifetime.
Man, I'm not allowed to vote here. Although I'm eligible to become a citizen in a year, but that's a conversation for another time. Carmi, thank you for being here. Thank you for your time.
So great being with you, David. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, an environmental advocate who's gone viral because he says you don't need to shower every day. And as a disgusting person with terrible hygiene, I tend to agree. So stay with us. And we are back with Donica McCarthy, who's an environmental auditor, campaigner, and author of The Prostitute State, How Britain's Democracy Was Hijacked. That's available wherever books are sold. But more importantly, he is an advocate for showering less. Welcome to the show, Donica.
Thank you. Good to be here. I'm not really an advocate of showering less. I'm an advocate of returning to the sink wash, which is what people did up to maybe the 60s. If you go to any aristocratic house in Britain, you'll see in the beautiful bedrooms of the house there was a washstand with a jug of water, and that's what people washed with up to the 1960s, really. And it uses 1 liter of water compared to 120 liters for a shower, and so it's phenomenally more environmentally friendly.
Every time I go to the UK, I always notice in bathrooms or washrooms or lavatories, however you want to call it, there's always a separate tap for hot and cold. And I'm always thinking, how am I supposed to wash my hands? It's too cold, it's too hot, it's too cold, it's too hot. Does that design have something to do with what you're talking about?
Nothing at all.
Why are the sinks like that in the UK? That's what I want to know.
Well, what the two different taps are is to allow you the freedom to have the temperature you want in the hot water. So you add hot water and then as much cold as you want. So it's actually giving you the freedom to have the temperature you want. But it's got nothing to do with water efficiency or energy efficiency.
But I want to run the water over my hands and the hot is too hot. You know what? We're totally off topic. I thought I hit on a good insight here and I didn't. Okay, so tell me about how we came to be a culture that showers way too much.
Well, I reckon it happened when energy became really cheap and people didn't really think about the environmental impacts of the energy. So when oil became really cheap, it became available to the masses. I mean, washing daily in hot water was a luxury that the aristocrats would have had, potentially. Obviously, working class people wouldn't have had access to that. So then when we had running water and cheap energy, we used water as if it was just, came from out of the sky. I know it does. But for me, a tap of water really is not just something that comes out of the tap. It comes from a river. It comes from a lake. It comes from nature. And in the south of England, we have less water per person than they do in Syria or in Spain because we have such a high population. So I think of water as something really precious. And so I use it for what I need rather than for my luxury.
I live and grew up on the Great Lakes now I live in the northeastern United States, but I grew up in southwestern Ontario in Canada. I'm used to just using tons of water and not thinking anything about it because we live on these lakes. But for 10 years, I lived in California, and my girlfriend would always criticize, ridicule my tap habits to the point where I started using less water. I started being more mindful. Would you recommend this sort of conservation to people who only live in areas where there isn't much water, or would you recommend it to everyone?
Well, I try and use an efficient form of washing for two reasons. One is because of protecting nature, not taking water out from the rivers and lakes and allowing it there for, because in England, you know, the rivers are running low in summer, and that has huge impacts on nature. But the second reason, of course, is the carbon impact. It takes around 600 light bulbs to heat the hot water for a shower. So you're running 600 light bulbs for the amount of time you're heating up the water. So I'm a passionate environmentalist. The science on climate is terrifying. So if we can actually radically reduce our carbon footprint, that makes sense. So the carbon footprint of my sink wash is 1/120th of the carbon footprint of a 10-minute electric shower. So if there's a family of four using an electric shower for a year, that's around 3 tons of carbon. Oh. What does that mean? We have a budget of around 1 ton per person for everything to stay under 2 degrees centigrade. So a lot of people with high showering frequency and high showering use, they're using their entire carbon footprint just for their shower. That's not tenable where we're at.
Is that true for gas as well as electricity?
It would be lower for gas, but it'd still be quite high. As I say, it's the equivalent of, I think I calculated a family of four using a power shower for 10 minutes a day. It's around 250,000 liters of water.
Wow.
Now, if you think about boiling a kettle of water to get it the right temperature, a kettle is 3,000 watts. That's a huge amount of energy to be used in a way that I think is wasteful. Gandhi said, live simply so other people can simply live. And I take that to heart. And that's what I'm about. I do a lot of media work. I do a lot of writing. I do a lot of journalism. I've written books about it, trying to persuade people to live lightly so that other people can live and we can stop trashing nature, stop trashing the climate. And this is a way of doing it.
I'm completely with you. And it's very hard to argue with you when you're quoting Gandhi so wonderfully like that. So a few years ago, you came out and said people should be being more efficient about how they wash, maybe washing less. It seems like every few years when there's an article that goes around, you're now the expert on this topic and you get ridiculed at times. What do you say to that? Do you have a good sense of humor when people joke around with you?
Well, being a media environmentalist, you have to have a sense of humor because, I mean, the abuse on Twitter is hilarious. You know, it's Stinky Commie is the latest one I got the other day. I don't know why commies should be particularly stinky, but and also there's so few communists around. It's quite bizarre that they should call people communists. But yeah, you have to have a sense of humor. But what I found interesting is actually the stats. Well, somebody said to me the other day on the BBC that they were doing an article about for BBC Worldwide. And they said to me, look, we've looked at the stats and there's millions of people who don't wash daily and there's millions of people who sink wash. But you're about the only person who will be willing to admit it. So that's why they come back to me. The stats are interesting. In America, they say that up to 40% of Americans don't shower daily.
Included is me. I'm like once every 3 or 4 days and my girlfriend hates it. She wishes I would shower more.
Well, maybe if she didn't shower for 3 days, she might like it. But I mean, I'm not saying that I don't care whether people shower and, you know, how many times they, it's up to you how many times you wash. I wash every day. So, you know, people don't complain about my smelling. But people have this weird idea that if you sink wash, which you wash your whole body with, you wash your face and your armpits and with a flannel, you wash your body, they still claim your smell. And that's just mad. It's just like, why do you have to have a shower or a bath to wash yourself? You don't. And you don't smell. But what I found fascinating about what happened, David, was that how many people came up to me and slinked up to me and kind of whispered in my ear, I do it too, Danica. I even had a professor of medicine at University College London, who I was involved in cycle campaigning in London. He came up to me and at a cycle protest we're organizing, he whispered in my ear, said, Danica, I sink wash every day as well. You're absolutely right. So that was, I thought it was like a good imprimatur of approval to get a professor of medicine saying he's doing it as well.
It sounds like your critics are strawmanning you, which for folks who don't know what that is, that's when you construct an argument on your opponent that isn't actually their position. For example, your position is use less water, care about the environment, be mindful of how much you're consuming both electricity and water, especially if you live in an area that doesn't have access to much water. And here's a way you can wash every day, which is not stinky. Like, that's your position. And you, the straw man is that you are against showers. Do you find that frustrating?
Yeah, well, the thing I find more frustrating is every single interview I had is that, don't you smell?
You know, I was waiting to ask you that question, Danica.
Well, you know, if I use soap and water on my armpits every day, do I smell? No, of course I don't. And my friends confirm, because they obviously seen me on TV or radio talking about this. Like, oh, God, there goes Danica again. And, you know, I don't seek out these interviews. They come to me, since I actually wrote an article for The Guardian 8 years ago about it. And I remember the day I wrote it thinking, oh, my God, what am I doing? Hundreds of thousands of people are going to know about my personal wash habits. What am I letting myself in for? And here I am 8 years later doing the same interview to people. But thankfully, you're not doing the same line. And what unfair dues to you. You're being honest about it. Like the how many? What's the population of America? 360 million, isn't it?
It's more than 25 people total. Maybe 26. No, yeah, something like that. 360 million.
So let's say 40% of those don't shower every day. We're talking about what's that? That's 40, 80, 120. It's around 130, 140 million people in America don't shower every day. They probably use a sink wash when they get up in the morning, like me. And is America full of stinky people? Of course it's not. It's very rarely you meet somebody who is.
Wait. I'm the one who lives here. I can confirm it's full of stinky people.
Really? Okay. Well, no. I think New York's probably different because, I mean, I have to say that when I used to fly for holidays when I was younger, I mean, New York's, you just walk out of the hotel and you're just sweat.
It's the sounds, it's the smells, it's the sights, it's the arguments that make New York the most terrible place in the world and the most amazing place in the world.
I would not live there for all the gold in China because it's too hot and it's too cold and it's too stinky and it's too humid. I would go mad there. Sorry. Well, what was the other interesting that came out was when I wrote the article for The Guardian was the medical side of it.
Yeah.
I remember I used to be a ballet dancer when I was younger, and one of my colleagues who was a dancer had damaged skin because he washed so often with soaps and with detergents, that sort of stuff. And he washed his skin so often it took away all the natural oils and it damaged him. He was in pain for the rest of his life. Now, the other thing that came out of the woodwork was pediatricians. They were saying that baby skin is so fragile. Washing it daily with soap or shampoo is not good for it. You should maximum maybe once or twice a week, what they said was maximum you should be doing. And the other thing at the other end of the scale was older people. Older people, once you get over my age, over 60, again, your skin starts getting more fragile. And again, dermatologists saying it's not good to wash it in soap every day and shampoo every day because it's not good for the skin. And I was doing an interview with BBC Scotland day before yesterday. And again, same interview. And this time they put me up against a virologist. They thought the virologist would rubbish me saying I'm unhealthy or whatever. It's disastrous for my skin health. And he just went, nope. Everything he's saying is correct. He's fine. There's no, it's actually good. We wash too much in the West. It's not good for our skin. So this virologist was set up to do an argy-bargy with me on BBC Scotland. And it didn't work out. We were on both of us agreeing. Oh, I totally agree with you.
So
they were left without an argument.
And I would hazard to say, again, I'm an armchair immunologist, but if you're not washing all the time, you're getting exposed to more grime and dirt and bacteria. And that actually trains your immune system to make it stronger. It's actually healthy.
And there was some truth in that, but what they were saying is that there is actually natural protective oils in our skin that are actually healthy and necessary for our skin. And the other thing, I mean, way back, I mean, I mentioned I was a dancer, but how I became involved in environmental issues was I had a pretty awful accident on the Opera House stage in Covent Garden. I was dropped on my head from 12 foot. My colleagues missed me, but my therapist was going to visit Yanomami Indians in the Amazon forest in 92. And I ended up by myself with the Yanomami Indians. And that's where I first became aware of the devastation we're doing to the environment and the impact that has on human beings. There were 6 million indigenous people in the Amazon when our civilization arrived, supposed civilization. There's now less than 600,000, David.
Wow.
And that genocide is continuing to this day. And that broke my heart. But which is going off on a tangent, but bring us back to the subject. What I notice about them, they just hopped in the river every day. They had no soap, no shampoo, and they had beautiful skin and beautiful hair, beautiful jet black hair. And I had dandruff at the time. I used shampoo and dandruff shampoo. And I came back to London. I said, well, that's kind of weird. And so I stopped using shampoo on my hair. I use soap on my armpits, et cetera, my face and my hands. But I stopped using shampoo on my hair. And you know what? My dandruff went.
Yeah.
Never came back.
Okay. Well, it sounds like we've got the dermatology reasons. We got the virology. We've got conservation reasons. And we've also run out of time. But before we started talking, you did warn me you had the gift of the gab. any advice for people who are trying to skip the daily shower routine or maybe move on to a wash basin, but they feel like they'll be too dirty or something like that?
Just get a flannel. Is that an English word that you understand? What a flannel?
No, that in American and Canadian English, that's like a shirt you wear. That's a fabric.
Okay. A flannel is a baby-sized towel. It's like a handkerchief-sized towel. And you use that for washing your body when you use a sink wash. And you put a towel on the floor if it's cold. But one last point, the one thing we didn't touch on is for poor people. You know, the financial cost of heating hot water is really, really expensive. I calculate for two people having an electric shower a year in would be around $364. So with cost of living and people having, you know, not having enough food for money for food, my showering costs £2.50 a year, my washing, £2.50 a year in hot water. So for poorer people, it can save them money and they can still be clean.
Wow. All right.
So money, climate, nature. It's a win-win-win, David.
Money, climate, nature, health. I've got everything I need to justify how much I shower, which is not very often. Donica, thanks for being here. I appreciate your time.
I really thank you so much. Enjoyed it.
Donica McCarthy is an environmental author, campaigner, and author of The Prostitute State, How Britain's Democracy Was Hijacked. That's available wherever books are sold. There he goes. I gotta go cook dinner. Thanks for listening. And here's the theme music. Goodbye.